Welcome to Film Fight Club. I'm Glenn Falkenstein from Falcon Screen, and we are joined by freelance writer and critic Virat Nehru.
Hello, everyone.
And Sydney filmmaker Chris Evans.
Good evening.
Now, we've got a big show tonight, lots to talk about. We're talking about a new Australian film, Frisky, made only $5,000 later in the program. Quite an achievement. We are talking about Studio Ghibli because the festival is on right now, and it's very exciting. Some of my favorite films are among Miyazaki's treasures. And we are talking, well, Chris, you may as well say it because you're particularly excited for this part of the program.
We'll be talking about what we can take away from David Lynch's magnum opus, the final two episodes of Twin Peaks, and why you should all experience this.
Yes, we have the biggest David Lynch fan on the show here, so we'll be getting quite
more into importantly, that. Can we actually take anything away from Twin Peaks? Does anything make sense? Or is that even important?
It's up for debate, to be sure.
Yes, let's debate this.
David Lynch loving continues. And
I'm sorry, Glenn. I know you're not a fan, but no, you have to put up with this. I'm sorry.
It's a football club. We should talk about David Lynch or Terrence Malick one week.
Yeah. Well, they did go to the same class. So
they went to the same class in film school. So, you know, the universe works in mysterious ways.
Well, not that mysterious if you're in the David Lynch production or a Terrence Malick production, because nobody knows anything.
Can you imagine that class? We're just going to do abstract today, purely abstract.
Yeah. I'm not interested in what this class is offering. I definitely enjoy being here, but I'm going to take away what I choose to.
Yes, I'm not a fan of these structured lessons. What is this? Yeah. You know, I like my abstract experience, thank you.
But for the first film, we're talking about something that's not at all abstract. Sorry, terrible segue there. And it is Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise's
I'm sorry. Tom Cruise is an abstract concept. Yes, he is.
Yes, we're getting quite some detail about Tom Cruise. We're talking about his new film, American Made. He's reuniting with his Edge of Tomorrow director, Doug Liman. He plays Barry Seal, drug runner for Pablo Escobar, the CIA, and a number of other shady characters in the 1980s. This is a true story in some respects. It is a prelude to the Iran-Contra scandal, which is dealt with actually sparingly in the film. Look, this film, a lot of money is thrown at this. A lot of Tom Cruise is thrown at this. Look, it's trying to be in the vein of Goodfellas, Wolf of Wall Street, and War Dogs, which came out last year, actually really preferred. Look, we know the shtick. It's trying to do an irreverent tone. It's the type of film, I know we're going to get into some detail, but it's the type of one, you know, I'd watch it on Netflix at 10 o'clock on a weeknight. It's not great. It's not bad, but it's somewhat enjoyable in parts.
But also, do I want to spend time, money, and energy on Tom Cruise being glib? I mean, I don't think so. Is that even important? Is that part of my life? What am I actually getting out of this experience?
Is he just glib through this entire film?
Pretty much. Like, that's it. There's nothing else. Not even any other shade of emotion, which is really weird.
I feel like Tom Cruise has sealed away his ability to portray genuine emotion. I mean, he was really good in Magnolia, right? But when has he seemed sincere since then?
Well, he came back, he resurrected his career and came back from The Edge of Tomorrow, pretty much.
Ooh, which they're making a sequel to.
Edge of Tomorrow is a really good movie.
And so is Oblivion. Good, like, he's made a few good films in the past few years. I liked Night and Day. I think it was underrated.
Well, Mission Impossible is
he's done the Mission Impossible in resurrecting his career, because people thought he was, you know, a nostalgic thing. People thought of him as something of the past, the 90s thing, you know, the Vanilla Sky kind of person, and Top Gun, and Tom Cruise when you think of the hair flying and beaches and naked men. But now he's more than that.
Okay. What?
This is the guy. Look, to this man's credit, he hung onto the side of a jet to film Mission Impossible 5. He was in his 50s. Who does that? Good for him.
All right. I enjoy Tom Cruise. I think he has a really magnetic presence. But there's something about his career right now that's a little bit unsettling, which is that Tom Cruise in, you know, this 80s, 90s Tom Cruise was like a beloved action movie star, as we know.
Yeah.
And then, you know, his career kind of, after the backlash from the Oprah interview in 2006, went off a cliff, and he's come back from that. But rather than evolving to the new stage, it's almost like since that moment, I don't know what is going through the man's head, but it sort of, from what we see in the output, it feels like he's trying to prove that he never fell off in the movies that he's making.
Which, in a way, is actually what Johnny Depp is trying to prove as well.
But what I see in Tom Cruise is that he produces a lot of his own films where he plays a young man. Like in the new Mummy movie,
that was not a highlight.
Like Russell Crowe says in the new Mummy that you're a young man. It's like he always plays younger characters. He's not admitting, he does look young, but he's not admitting his age or where he is in this career. And he's trying to keep alive the career of a young action movie star who, you know, producing movies like Mission Impossible, where he gets to be like cool, amazing, can do everything.
Speaking of which, the Top Gun sequel in production.
Right, exactly.
In 2019, I think.
Exactly. It seems like I wish that this guy would be more vulnerable and, it, you know, rather than trying to prop up this position and prove that he can still do it all the time. And maybe if he were more vulnerable, he'd be turning in a performance that isn't so glib.
But maybe that's the difference between a star or a celebrity and an actor, because Tom Cruise is not an actor. He's a persona. And for him, the only way to survive right now is to keep up the persona.
But is it okay to have someone who's larger than life? I mean, Tom Cruise, as I think it is, one of the few remaining surviving huge actors of the 80s and 90s who has not gone into television, who maintains this persona and image of a classic movie star. And to do that, it's okay, like Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall, all those who preceded him, to be larger than life. And he's choosing roles to that extent. And it kind of works in a lot of the good ones.
It's a bit circumspect to put Tom Cruise in that category of like Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall, Tom Cruise. That's a bit of a... I'm sorry, Glenn.
Okay, bit of a stretch.
It's true, though. He comes from the age of movie stars.
Yes, I agree.
Someone like Chris Hemsworth is never going to be, as great as he is, he's never going to be, to the general public, you know, an icon of money, fame, Hollywood, on the level that Tom Cruise is. We just simply don't create movie stars like Jimmy Stewart or Tom Cruise anymore. I agree with Glenn.
Yeah, but I mean, look, he runs this persona for the entire movie. I mean, there's a scene where, and it's been heavily used in the trailers, where he crashes a plane in the middle of a suburban neighborhood and cocaine just showers over him. And it's that crazy shtick that we've seen through all these recent films, barring, I think, Collateral and a couple of others, even Rock of Ages. You know,
yeah, Collateral would be another great performance to see, right? I want to see something like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I enjoyed him in that. And he obviously can do this stuff. Look, he's enjoying doing these reaction films. And right. There are a lot of parts of this that were actually really fun.
Right, right. But is he just keeping this Tom Cruise persona alive? Is that the purpose of a movie like this?
But
to keep the mega movie star thing going?
Even then, like, actually, if we compare with Robert Downey Jr., post-Iron Man, he's just doing the same shtick.
Yeah, he said that he'd never do a small movie again.
Yeah,
Robert Downey Jr.
But then, you know, is it small movie or a small ego? It's a bit, you know, different to...
Okay, from what I've heard about the film, Glenn enjoyed it a lot more than Virat. What did you not like about it beyond Tom Cruise's glib performance?
The movie is about nothing in particular. I think that's the problem. It's trying to be that American movie about patriotism and American values in some sense. You know, the title is American Made, but it's not made by Clint Eastwood. And in that sense, that's the film's biggest flaw. There's something that Eastwood has been able to tap into about contemporary America, which no other director has been able to do.
Scorsese, I'd argue, quite
well. But, yeah, but I don't think it's particularly American in that sense. There's something distinctly about conservative America, which Eastwood can do. Something like Sully, which was, I would say, the best, the daddest dad movie of the year.
But nothing happened in Sully. Like
exactly. And nothing happens in this movie either.
Yeah,
but Sully worked for some reason because it had some sort of emotional undercurrent.
I think the issue here was, I mean, that idea works in where you have a good script, where you have good actors, but who actually have a substantive role. You could be forgiven for watching this movie or seeing the promotional material and not knowing that Domhnall Gleeson was in it, that Caleb Landry was in it, that Sarah Wright was in it. They were passing figures compared to Cruise, who was in every moment of the film. And if you get an actor like Domhnall Gleeson, you know, actually put him to work. He's been in the string of amazing projects. Caleb Landry, he has pretty good range, but in this, he's just playing the exact same role that he's played in quite a few of these other films. Sarah Wright, who's great, Goodfellas, this is very similar to Goodfellas in some respect. Yeah. That worked because of Ray Liotta's partner. She played an active role in that you could see the audience's views of the film reflected in her, and this wasn't evident in here.
I agree. Like, the one very distinctive feeling I took away from this was that I need to get back home and watch the new season of Narcos, because that is so much better than this. You know, because that's what this movie was trying to be. And even it has Pablo Escobar. So it is definitely going for that vibe, but failed miserably because it is just glib and blank.
Ooh.
Ooh. So, yeah, American Made, on that note, is in cinemas now. We will be back very shortly talking about Studio Ghibli. Stay tuned. It's all the same. Only the names will change. Every day.
it seems we're wasting away. Another place where the faces are so cold. I drive all night just to get back home. Oh, I'm a cowboy on a steel horse I ride. I want it dead or alive. I want it.
And that was, of all people, Tom Cruise singing Bon Jovi's Dead or Alive from Rock of Ages, where he played Stacey Jacks. Didn't enjoy the film so much, but the Broadway and West End productions, in fact, any production of it is absolutely fantastic, so please do seek it out. But
I think the movie is good trash. There's a lot wrong with it, but, you know, it's fun.
Tom Cruise was, I think he was the best part of it.
Tom Cruise was definitely the best part of it.
I mean, but there's something to be said about good trash. I think I enjoy good trash.
I do too, but on the subject of things that are good and not trash at all.
Yes, our segue is very counterintuitive in this episode.
Yeah.
No, well, this was perfectly planned. Come on, guys.
Yep. Yeah. So something that is not trash and is good is Studio Ghibli. And currently the Studio Ghibli Festival is on at cinemas around Australia. Running from August 24th to September 20th.
So. Yeah, so you've got a couple of weeks to check out what else is playing. It's been a bit all over the place, like the scheduling of the movies. You really have to check with your local cinema guides to find out what's on when, because I've often been blindsided by, oh, this is on now? I guess I've got to rearrange my schedule.
But also,
really thankful to see these on the big screen.
The fantastic thing is, like, each and every Studio Ghibli movie is actually playing in cinemas.
Every single one.
Which means, like, and I
including their short films.
I feel not guilty at all in admitting this, that even though I'm a huge Studio Ghibli fan, I have missed out a lot of movies, and I didn't even realize it until I actually looked at the entire list. I'm like, whoa, there's so much I haven't seen.
Exactly. There's a lot I haven't seen. And I consider myself a huge Ghibli nut as well, because Spirited Away is one of the movies that really ignited my passion for movies at an earlier, when I was a kid. So it's strange to realize
I think that there is that moment with every movie fan goes through, where you start from Spirited Away and then you migrate to, more mature taste, and you go to Totoro and then The Wind Rises.
Spirited Away is still a fantastic
film. I agree.
It is wonderful.
If you haven't seen that, that's the easiest film that they have on to watch, because it plays a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of sessions of Spirited Away, definitely you can catch that. It's a landmark film.
Yeah, please,
really worth seeing.
Please do. This was the first Studio Ghibli film I ever saw. My sister and I used to watch these films in SBS, like on a weeknight at 8:30 whenever they were on, and we just fell in love with them. They're absolutely fantastic, and they still are.
You're just admitting that you are like such a snob, Glenn. We used to watch Studio Ghibli on SBS with my sister.
That's where they were on. That's where you got them.
Okay, I've caught only a few films from the festival. I'm going to try and catch a few more as it goes on, but some I'd like to speak up for. I caught Porco Rosso, which is one of the only Miyazaki movies I hadn't seen. Even though it's not one of my favorites, it shows what's so unique about Miyazaki, his ability to conjure up a world that feels really comfortingly nostalgic and familiar, and yet is so otherworldly and fantastical in some ways. This incredible attention to detail and his warmth and spirit and generosity towards his characters. And I think even though he's a very different director, Isao Takahata, whose films are also showing at the festival, who isn't as famous as Hayao Miyazaki, has a very different approach, but once again, the thing that unites them and creates that Ghibli feeling is this warmth and generosity towards the characters. I'd really recommend people to seek out another film that's playing at the festival if they get the chance to see it, which is The Tale of Princess Kaguya, which is the final film.
Fantastic.
Yeah, the final film by Isao Takahata, which is an incredibly moving and mature work, as is Hayao Miyazaki's final film, The Wind Rises. Both deeply humane and personal works from master directors.
And I know we'll get to Twin Peaks later on, Chris, but I just realized, and it hit me right now, it's a parallel between world building.
Yes,
that's
exactly
kind of world
right.
building that Lynch happens in, that kind of internal worlds that collide with each other.
People,
and that's what Studio Ghibli is famous for.
Both in Tale of Princess Kaguya and The Wind Rises both bring forward this idea that's really important to David Lynch in Twin Peaks as well, which is the power of dreams.
Yes.
And what the power dreams can bring to our world, the clashing of the internal and the external. Through the fantastical elements, they get to saying something true about the way that we live our lives.
And even though I think Glenn kind of hates David Lynch, he likes Studio Ghibli. So there is some meeting point.
I do, for this one, okay, I think it works really well. I love the idea of dreams, dreamscape, dream escapism. And one of my favorites, I played at the Sydney Film Festival last year, was The Red Turtle.
That was fantastic.
Which was a co-production with a Dutch company, but it had almost no dialogue throughout, but it was emotive, it was moving. And there were dream sequences as such. There was pathology, as in many of his films, deeply, deeply woven in there. It was a short one, and it's pretty consumable. I think it's someone who's definitely worth catching.
Like all Ghibli films, it said a lot with images. Words weren't so necessary. Red Turtle has no words at all.
Exactly.
And while other Ghibli films may have a lot of words, they really convey their meaning and through the power of images and visual poetry.
And music.
And music.
There's a scene where the reeds are rustling, and it's just about as powerful. Oh, and when the water comes slamming on the beach, it's so impactful. It's so frightening.
That's right. And
I feel actually just envious in that sense, where how you can bring out a world which is completely in your head, so realistically. And I just want to, you know,
it's what film art is about. On the subject of their music, I'd like to point out that Joe Hisaishi, Miyazaki's longtime composer collaborator, has created some of the most memorable themes in the history of film music. And it's wonderful to hear that music on the big screen. There's one more film I saw caught at the festival that I'd like to talk about, because it's a more underseen Studio Ghibli film. And it does remind me of what we were saying about the power of dreams. It's called Whisper of the Heart. If you get a chance to see it, please do. It's a movie written and with art direction by Hayao Miyazaki, but directed by another director who tragically died not very long after the film came out in a car accident. But Whisper of the Heart is about a young girl and her life, essentially. It's about her uncertainty about her future, her having a crush on a boy she meets at school, just simple things that are true to life. But it shows how powerfully these things affect her and how they come to influence her dreams. And it shows how she comes to share those dreams with other people in order to reach kind of spiritual and emotional wholeness in the forms of channeling her emotions into writing a book. Yeah. It's a beautiful metaphor for art and how strong emotions are to you when you're at that age. They find a way through all sorts of stories they tell, World War II biopics, simple stories of everyday life, complete fantasy tales like Princess Mononoke or Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind, to say something true about humanity and what's good about us. And I think that's a legacy Studio Ghibli have built that will never be forgotten.
There are not enough movies that talk about the good of humanity, and I think we definitely need more of that. There's a lot of cynicism, there's a lot of black comedy, but not enough.
And they do so in a way that's sincere, that isn't just artificial manipulation to make us feel good about ourselves.
And it's not just their emotional legacy. I mean, the animation itself has been so adapted, and homages paid to anime and general cinema generally.
They are masters of the form of animation.
Once you see a Studio Ghibli film, and then you go back to, you know, that Disney Pixar style of animation or just CGI, you just feel so empty.
It reminds us of how many possibilities there are outside of what we usually are exposed to,
and
how many alternatives there
are. Detailing, you know, that's something, you know, even the rustling of the leaves, you can hear it and you can see it. It's that sort of very sensory experience.
It's very Japanese in in how attuned it is to the subtle elements of the natural world.
And the one, it's just beautifully done. And Totoro, you watch it and you can see how it's influenced so many like films.
Yes.
The one based on The Borrowers, which is one of my favorites.
Arrietty. Secret World of Arrietty, I think it's called in English.
And has the stoic figure as the dad, and he just humph and just move and make these little grimaces and say more about his character than anything
else. That's right. It's in the animation, the detail that they bring to small movements, as you say, like the harumph of this of this man, or the old lady in Spirited Away, the wrinkles in her face and the way she hobbles around, you know, or the way that the Totoro moves in Totoro, big, heavy footsteps. It's just, there's joy in witnessing their animation art.
But also, it's the closest you get to kind of fiction novelistic style of storytelling.
Yeah.
You know, because that's when you really, I mean, a writer would emphasize these movements to show character development, but often the visual medium robs that.
They're using the film medium to the fullest. Yeah. Check them out on the big screen if you can.
Oh, definitely. Please do.
Yes, please do. The festival's on for 2 more weeks. We'll be back momentarily talking about Twin Peaks. Stay tuned.
Twilight is gone. And no songbirds are singing. when the twilight is gone, you come into my heart, and here in my heart you will stay while I pray. My prayer.
And that was My Prayer by The Platters, a very significant song in the new season after a 25-year hiatus of Twin Peaks, which just wrapped up and has David Lynch fans all around the world, including one right here in the studio. Just, very...
Brains have been fried by it, I'd say.
If you could see Chris right now, there is true submission to divinity.
Yes.
Get off the table, Chris.
No, honestly... That's how I feel. Even though we've spoken before about, is it TV, is it film? This is, I think, first of all, it doesn't matter because TV and film are ultimately the same art of images and cinema and motion and sound. But this definitely owes more to film in the way that it is a work where the meaning is comes most, not so much through dialogue, but through the power of images.
Yeah.
So the new Twin Peaks, for me... I thought I would just be able to say so much about this without thinking about it, which I guess is true, but it's hard to know where to start because I was affected by this so profoundly. I thought I'm doing the job of film criticism here on Film Fight Club, and there's no way that I could not speak about something like this when it moved me as profoundly as it has. I know that this is a very love it or hate it experience that David Lynch has created with the new, the last two episodes of his Twin Peaks show. But I think for me, it's what cinema is all about. The show preceding it has had its ups and downs.
Yeah,
it's
definitely.
It's had its flaws. It's had its great moments and its flaws. But what he's created in this finale is sublime. It brings forth, first of all, incredibly innovative cinematic technique to express David Lynch's ideas, but it manages to give us so much. It gives you moments of incredible, indescribable horror, as well as moments of jubilation and joy. It simultaneously addresses really deep themes, but also gives us something as silly as an intentionally bad scene that we get ironic joy out of in the way that you might watch something like The Room. And, he's generous enough to give us so much.
And actually, on that, actually, I would definitely just pay respects to Kyle MacLachlan. I mean,
yes, what he's Kyle MacLachlan.
Just what he's been able to do in those, especially yes. in those intentionally
That's exactly
bad
right.
scenes.
That's exactly right. This new Twin Peaks shows us in... its premise of identity shifting, which has become David Lynch's obsession since the first Twin Peaks aired and has been part of every work he's made since, he has allowed Kyle MacLachlan to show off this incredible range. In this show, we see him showing, he splits Agent Cooper, the character that was so important to the original Twin Peaks, through a prism so that we can see every different shade of Agent Cooper
yes,
imaginable.
Literally, in literal sense, actually, you see Kyle MacLachlan in...
Yeah, that's right.
Very
every side of himself that he could show. So, just a few thoughts before we move on beyond this. This new Twin Peaks, what is it about? What does it give us? For me, I think the original Twin Peaks, through all its genre trappings... David Lynch felt was at its core a story about abuse. And so in using the opportunity to revisit this, instead of just creating a nostalgic sequel to give people the fan service of seeing the characters that they love again 25 years later, he's taken this idea really seriously and he's used it as an opportunity to take the themes of the original show further. So what we have now is a very strange, abstract, winding pathway of a show that explores the idea of how does abuse affect us over time? Where do we move forward when there's a trauma in our past? What scars are too much to bear?
Or
can we move on?
Yeah, exactly.
Do we move on?
Yes.
This finale gives people the challenges the audience. How do we react to the traumas of our life? Actually, can we move on? What is a way to live in a healthy way?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point Chris has made, and I just want to cap that off. A lot of TV and a lot of film, what I think Chris and I agree on, which very few things we agree on, but this is one of the things we do agree
on. This is Fight Club.
Yeah, one of the few things we agree on is that it's very passive.
Yes.
And you know, what Twin Peaks is not, it's not passive.
That's right.
It's very active. In fact, it asks you to actually engage.
And that's exactly right.
Basically, fill in the gaps. And you know, you form your own narrative. Narrative is not given
to you.
That's
exactly right. It asks us to do something, but if we go with it, it gives us something.
Exactly.
Now, just to wrap up, I'd like to say that as a confession, I've been kind of getting disillusioned with films lately because I watch so many films that seem just to not be saying anything or giving us anything that it's almost not worth the time that I invest in films. I started to get a little bit disillusioned. Seeing something this good reminds me of why I love film so dearly, because this film gave me something that I could relate to my own life. This film gives me something that was so much more worth the time that it gave, that I gave to it. And for that, I'm incredibly grateful to David Lynch. I could not recommend anything to our listeners more than this new series of Twin Peaks.
That's remarkable. I mean, I've never heard Chris say something so just emotive and so just invested in something.
He was
so,
tearing up, yeah. If you could listen.
It moved me to my core.
Yeah, so I'm committing now. I watched it like the first two episodes quite a few years ago, but I'm telling you right now, I'm going to go, because what you said, I'm going to go and watch all three seasons.
Even if you hate it, and the film, even if you hate it, I'm sure you'll see it as being something truly unique.
And knowing how much Glenn actually hates David Lynch, that's a big commitment. I respect you, and I will give you a big hug after the show, Glenn.
So we will report back 1 week once we've had all review the three seasons of Twin Peaks, which I am looking forward to. But in the time we have left, we are talking about Frisky, which is an Australian film by writer, director, and producer and star Claudia Pickering. She plays Chloe. It's quite an amazing thing that she's produced this and achieved this on a $5,000 budget. It's about a character called Chloe who goes over to the US to start a PR agency with her best mate, played by Monica Ammerman. It's about relationships, roommates. We mentioned The Room earlier, which is also set in San Francisco. This is a much better film than The Room. It is a love letter to San Francisco. It is a love letter to life. It is
maybe it's a compliment if you say it's compared to The Room, because a lot of people do like The Room as well. So.
This is far better than The Room. Look, I mean, this is quite a fun film. It's a lot of good humor. It's a lot of dark humor, which I was very impressed at. I'm sure the director of this was a fan of Seinfeld, because there's a lot of it revolves around a dog and a storyline you would not particularly expect. But yeah, not what I was expecting at all.
Oh, I loved it. Look, one of my favorite sort of true lines of the film, and watch what I don't get to see, and this is something I know people roll their eyes as soon as I say it. I'm like, you know, real female friendships. We don't get to see genuine female friendships on screen, which don't involve, you know, men or, you know, passive aggressiveness. We, you know, the main leads are two just female best friends. And they run with that for the entire film and pulling no punches, which was so refreshing to see and was so much fun.
They have a really interesting dynamic. I mean, they've clearly invested a lot of time, thought, effort into this film. And just the surrounding characters, they're a pretty eclectic group. The main guy, Sam, the one of the roommates, I feel I wanted to narrate my life. He was just so interesting.
He was so savage. And also, I do know some of those people in my life as well who just tell you straight out, like, how terrible a person you are. But I need them, because sometimes you need people to tell you that you're just being a bad person. And you can't face up to that. So you need people in your life to tell you that, hey, you know what? Just deal with it. Move on. You know, just sucker up and be frisky.
Yeah, be frisky, yes.
Go live.
Yeah, it's one of those films that encourages you, like the filmmaker did, just get out there, do something, in this case, make a movie or start a PR agency or do whatever.
But
it's
also
affirming. It's
but
an affirming
also, narrative. The low budget is not actually a precursor or a bar to the actual standard of film and filmmaking. You know, the way it's shot is fantastic. The art direction and, you know, what was achieved by that very intimate crew was spectacular. The sound design was fantastic. The location and how the scenes are set, even though it's, you know, in a share house, but it's a love letter to San Francisco. So, you know, that if you love those kind of films where, you know, it's basically based in a city and capturing city vibe, it's a beautiful film.
Yeah, please do check it out. It's available on iTunes. It's Frisky. And yeah, please do. It's Australian cinema. And we do great work.
Such a good time for Aussie cinema right now. There's Ali's Wedding. There's That's Not Me,
which is opening in cinemas tomorrow. Please do check it out. It's got some great coverage all over the place. And it's absolutely worth seeing. It's in Palace Cinemas on September 7th.
There's Frisky. There's The Killing Ground. There's so much good stuff out there. Aussie stuff. Go Aussie.
There is. And please also check out the Sydney Latin American Film Festival. It opens tomorrow night at Dendy Opera Keys, running from September 7th to 11th. I'll be there. And they're playing some awesome films. We've got a wrap up. The Sonic Assassin is up next. Enjoy movies. Good night.
Good night, all.
Good night.